This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The smoke is yet to clear after the Hawaii Supreme Court invalidated results of the election in the East Honolulu District covering Hawaii Kai to Waikiki. Residents we talked to over the weekend aren't sure what to make of the unprecedented development. When will they head back to the polls? Will it be a runoff between Trevor Ozawa and Tommy Waters, or include others whose names appeared on the District 4 ballot? Some folks told us they don't plan to vote. Others say the redo won't change who they plan to vote for. It was a mixed bag all around.
What do you think about this redo on the election?
I think they should just stop, and it's wasting taxpayers' money, and that's all I have to say.
The fight is, Waters is saying that the votes that did not make it to, what is it, the council by 6 p.m. is the one that's being fought for? Well, if that's the facts, then, you know, I think he deserves a recount or a revote, shall we say. You know, the facts are there. He asked for the facts, and that's what it came out. And the court says, yeah, let's do it again, and I think that's fair.
Think it'll change your vote?
Probably not. I'll probably stick with the same vote.
I think it's unfortunate because, yeah, there's a lot of money was spent to run an election like every time we have elections, and it's understandable that, you know, people would be concerned about, oh man, you know, where's the money going to come from and we have to do this again. But on the flip side, you know, if what they're saying is accurate, that ballots were picked up after a deadline and there's no way to differentiate, you know, those ballots from the previous ones that were, you know, quote unquote on time, then you're kind of stuck. You're kind of put in a position where the results need to be, you know, looked at again closely. And I mean, I guess if the margin of victory was well over 350 or 300 or what have you, then I guess it would be harder to say, let's have a re-election or a revote. But 22, I mean, that's plausible. I think, you know, for me living out here, I think it's plausible that 22 votes could be in there. I think it's interesting, you know, and I'm going to vote again once this all gets sorted out or once we get our ballots or however they're going to do it.
And do you think you'll change your vote?
No. I mean, you know, the candidate I voted for, I you know, trust in that person. I'll continue to, you know, support them. And but I think it's the right thing ultimately, given the circumstances. You drop an egg, man. You don't try to just scoop it up off the ground and make it work. You just got to go get another egg.
Just after the Hawaii Supreme Court handed the decision down late Friday afternoon, it was an elated Tommy Waters who talked to HPR.
I'm very pleased with the Hawaii Supreme Court decision today. I'm very grateful for the hard work that the justices put in to this matter. They asked all the right questions, all the same questions that I had, and I'm looking forward to a spirited special election. The Supreme Court did not actually give a remedy. They did validate the election, so I'm assuming there's going to be a special election.
Trevor Ozawa, who stands to be unseated, raised the question of whether some of the justices should have recused themselves because of possible conflicts during the judicial selection process.
In this past election, the U.S. Postal Service collected the 350 ballots in dispute prior to the 6 p.m. deadline. Each of them was scanned in, and they were held safely at the U.S. Postal Service at the airport for the city clerk's office to come and pick up. The Supreme Court refuses to recognize this designation of the duty to collect the absentee mail-in ballots. All elections in the past 30 years were handled this way, with the same rules. So why was my election the only one ever to be invalidated? Fair question.
In response, the Hawaii State Judiciary released the following statements over the weekend saying, quote, judges are guided by the Hawaii Revised Code of Judicial Conduct. It provides guidance to assist judges in maintaining the highest standards of judicial and personal conduct, including when making a determination on whether or not to sit on a particular case. Until the Office of Elections and the City Clerk's Office clears the smoke, the Honolulu City Council will meet this week to choose someone to represent the affected district. If they can't agree, the decision could fall to the mayor. Time to get our reality check this morning with our partners at Honolulu Civil Beat. Reporter Nathan Eagle sets the stage for rising sea levels. Do we retreat or fortify the shoreline? Morning, Nathan.
Good morning.
So you pretty much set the stage out there looking at the various bills that the lawmakers are have introduced.
Absolutely, yeah. There's no shortage of them, you know, a dozen or more that deal with climate change directly, or and many more that deal with it indirectly. So there's a lot of very big questions before Hawaii lawmakers, and in turn, obviously, us, the public, from everything from where do we armor our shorelines or where should we retreat because of rising sea levels. We've got carbon tax proposals on the table, homebuyer disclosures, you know, that being, should you tell a prospective home buyer that you live in an area that's going to be underwater in the coming years, and a whole bunch more.
Now, what's your sense as to, you know, what might get, you know, hearings first, or what might be really doable?
Well, looking at what happened last year, there's a couple of clues on some of them that have been tried before. You know, there's some that suggest we should implement the findings of this huge sea level rise report that the State Climate Commission did, I think, December 2017. So that had cleared the Senate last year, if I'm not mistaken, but then died in the House. So I think they'll push that again. It hasn't changed, as far as I can tell. So maybe they'll have better luck this year in trying to get some more traction in the House. Some of the others, though, I haven't seen debated before, I don't recall, such as the carbon tax. So that one, I think, will be highly controversial. But it is something that our State Climate Commission unanimously approved. And then some of the others are kind of a mix somewhere in between those two.
And I know there's been discussion about carbon offsets for folks who don't like the idea of a tax.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's a number of carbon offsets from stuff, I think, to help consumers do that, to having the state kind of offset its own emissions for its own employees.
And the disclosures, the real estate disclosures.
Yeah, absolutely. So that one has been tried before and obviously didn't pass, or we wouldn't be talking about it. But that's, again, there's these powerful mapping tools that are now available to the public online through the state's report that show you, you know, what 1 foot of sea level rise looks like, 2 feet, 3 feet over the next, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. But the question is, if you're buying a home in one of those areas, should you have to tell the buyer that you live in one of these areas, that your home could potentially be underwater within the next generation or maybe a lot sooner?
And the lawmakers are also looking at, you know, how do we plan for retreating or building up?
Yeah, and that one I'm imagining there will be a lot of debate over. So I spoke to Senator Carl Rhodes, for instance, who's introduced this bill that says, hey, Climate Commission, can you at least give us a list, you know, maybe prioritize a list of areas you think we should armor, build seawalls and things like that to protect us, and areas that make sense to retreat. But in his opinion, you know, things like harbors, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Let's armor that and protect it. But for him, you know, Waikiki, which is all of the mapping shows to be underwater in the near future, he's like, that's something we should retreat from. That's his opinion. But, you know, in talking to like Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell, he's like, no, absolutely. We are going to protect Waikiki and Kaka'ako, places like that, that are such a big economic driver. So I think you're going to see a lot of debate in terms of what is on which of those lists.
This is interesting to me because I just recently took a underground tour of the city of Seattle, looking at areas that the city had abandoned because of a really bad fire. But you can go actually underground and look at where there was a hotel and where there was a bank. And it was just kind of looking back at the future of what could come in Waikiki. Just really fascinating.
Oh, that's super fascinating.
So we'll have to see what happens. When's the first hearing? Do you got anything today or tomorrow?
Not that I've seen scheduled so far. I haven't made it my way through all the lists of everything. they're definitely coming in frequently and with a lot of different bills being on the table. I'll be keeping an eye on them.
Okay, I haven't waded through them all yet. All right, thanks so much, Nathan.
Thank you.
That was reporter Nathan Eagle with today's Reality Check. To read Nathan's full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Aloha, I'm Jairus Grove from the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
Officials are optimistic they can eradicate the infestation of little fire ants discovered recently in a Kaneohe neighborhood. The department was successful when a larger population was found in Mililani several years ago. It was eventually deemed little fire ant free. We talked to Becky Azama, the plant pest control manager of the State Department of Agriculture.
Someone in the home was being stung inside on the sofa. The infestation, other than inside the home, was when we went to survey the property, it was found pretty much in along the boundaries of the property, the residence, and along the patio area of the home.
Do we have any idea where it came from?
We do not. It could have come in anywhere, and that's the reason why when we did survey the one property and found it on the edges of the property, we had to expand the survey and found more ants in the neighboring property. So there are altogether 11 properties being treated. So we don't really know how the ants came to Oahu.
Well, is this in a subdivision or in an area that's more country?
It's in the subdivision, yes, and it's surrounded by roadways where the ants don't normally cross unless items or articles are moved. So there's the natural boundaries are the roadways.
So it might have been brought in by some plant material, nursery material?
Possible. The ants can live in anything. It could live in people's vehicles, their private vehicles, or any. We even heard of the machete handle had a crack in it, and there a colony of ants in there. So
really?
Anywhere that the ants can find shelter and still have access to food and moisture, water. So it could be anything.
So give us a snapshot. I know they've had problems with the little fire ant on the Big Island, and I think Maui, right?
Yes, Big Island is basically controlling what is on each person's property. The residents need to control the ants there. Maui, there's still believed chance for eliminating the populations, and it's continuing projects to eliminate the ants there.
So is it basically a lost cause for the Big Island, though?
I wouldn't say lost cause. I believe property owner, manager needs to work together with the communities. And, you know, it makes a difference when neighbors help each other cooperate and control the ants. So it just kind of ripples outwards if, you know, each owner is responsible.
And is the infestation on any particular side of the Big Island?
It originally was on the east side, and we understand now that more calls are being received for the west Hawaii.
Well, that's unfortunate.
Yes.
So tell us about the treatment.
So the first thing that we do is identify what kinds of ants, and that is by receiving a sample and then looking under the microscope for the features of the ants, identifying it, and then from there, then the set plan is plan of treatment was developed by the Hawaii Ant Lab, and they are based in our Hilo office. But their treatment plan that was developed has been proven to be effective in controlling the ants and eliminating them. What we've been using is bait form, so that the ants will take the food baits back to their nests and eliminate the colony slowly that way, and eventually the queen will be fed the toxicant and stop the egg laying or, you know, egg producing part. The chemical in the pesticide we use, one of them anyway, is called hydromethanone. So we use a combination of the granular baits on the ground, and we also use a slurry, and it's able to be shot up into the trees or what where the ants live.
Right, because it's important, I think, to underscore that, is that they can nest in trees. And so if you're just hiking along in the forest or walking around your backyard, they could drop on you.
That's right. They'll drop and they'll be able to sting. And they may not come down to the ground to feed. So that's why we need to put the bait up where they can feed on them.
Right. So you just need everybody to be vigilant in that area.
We do. The treatment cycle is about every 6 weeks that we would treat. And the treatment goes on for 8 treatments. So sure. It's a long process. But as in Mililani, we've had success. And, you know, that success is really based on we had great cooperation with the residents. I cannot tell you or emphasize enough that because of that we work together, the population is gone. How important it is that everybody work together.
Best advice for folks if they bring plants home from somewhere, quarantine it and just take
a test. Maybe they could, you know, do that quick peanut butter test before they bring anything. I mean, it's not, like I said, not only plants, but any article, if they're moving them from the Big Island, they can do the quick peanut butter stick test and see what kind of ants or if they have any ants there.
And so we just don't know why. They just really like peanut butter, huh?
It's that protein. They prefer the protein and oil-based foods.
Interesting.
Yes.
Okay. No, but that's good advice. All right. So if you bring any kind of plant material or something, just to be safe, put some peanut butter out.
Yes. And they can always go to our plant quarantine branch offices on the neighbor islands. You know, if there's any suspects, we have the pest hotline they can phone in, and it's 643-PEST or 7378. I've already gotten a few calls from Kaneohe asking, you know, if we have checked their neighborhoods, and we will do a larger, broader sweep at some time with our partner agencies.
That was Becky Azama, Plant Pest Control Branch Manager for the State Department of Agriculture. She was talking about what's being done to get a Windward Oahu neighborhood little fire ant free.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Kahilu Theater on Hawaii Island, presenting Tomas Kubinek, self-titled Certified Lunatic and Master of the Impossible, blending theater and music hall performance art, February 6th, kahilutheater.org.
As the government gets back to business this morning after being shut down for more than a month, HPR's Ryan Finnerty looks at how Hawaii's biosecurity was affected.
Some impacts of the government shutdown were pretty immediate. Longer security lines at airports, a freeze on certain federal loans. Others were not as immediately apparent, like the effort to control invasive species coming to Hawaii.
The Hawaii Interagency Biosecurity Plan is our path forward for the next 10 years.
That's Joshua Atwood, Invasive Species Coordinator for the Hawaii Department of Land and Natural Resources. In 2017, the state of Hawaii adopted that 10-year plan to prevent new invasives from arriving and control the ones already here. Much of that work is done by state agencies, but not all of it.
The plan describes the state's part in this broader biosecurity program that is ongoing every day, and that is a collaboration of state and federal agencies. So Customs and Border Patrol, they're the ones that are looking for invasive species in international cargo. So that's a huge reliance we have on federal agencies. Thankfully, for domestic cargo coming into the state, that's mostly taken care of by the Hawaii Department of Agriculture.
Customs and Border Protection, part of the Department of Homeland Security, is one of the agencies that ran out of funding during the shutdown. CBP agents inspect all foreign cargo for unwanted pests. Those agents were considered essential and worked without pay during the 35-day budget lapse. But there are more than just customs agents involved. It's a veritable alphabet soup of federal agencies.
We also work with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, both their plant protection and quarantine program, which sets the regulations for what can come in to the state in international cargo. Then we also work with their wildlife services side of the U.S. Department of Agriculture to haze animals from airports so that there aren't collisions with jets. They do a lot of research for us out of the National Wildlife Research Center that's based in Hilo on ways that we can control rats or mongoose or rat lungworm disease. And so obviously none of that is going forward right now. And then the other federal agencies that we work with, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service is a major partner. The Pacific Islands Fish and Wildlife Office deals with a lot of the impacts of invasive species to federally listed threatened and endangered species. And then we also work with the National Park Service primarily on access to parklands where invasive species control needs to happen.
The shutdown also hit other areas of environmental research.
We're also working on registration for pesticides in Hawaii. That would happen through EPA and through the U.S. Department of Agriculture. So our work on that stopped. Anything that has to do with federal funding, basically, you know, there we run the risk of, depending on how the agreement is set up, if we are spending state money and then applying for federal reimbursement on a grant, then those reimbursements aren't coming through.
Federal agencies also play a major role in addressing a threat to one of Hawaii's most important native plants.
One of the major federal entities that is working on the rapid ohia death problem in Hawaii is the U.S. Forest Service and the USDA Agricultural Research Service in Hilo. So they operate laboratories that are testing samples of trees to see where rapid ohia death, the fungus, is currently found in Hawaii. So the University of Hawaii partners that they do that work with are still working, but they can't use the federal labs, and none of the federal scientists are able to work on those issues right now.
While the government was shut down, state scientists couldn't use federal labs and equipment on Hawaii Island. Many federal scientists were furloughed.
Our main partners in this endeavor, two of our main partners are the USDA Forest Service and the USDA Agricultural Research Service, both here in Hilo.
That's J.B. Friday, a forester with the University of Hawaii. Friday's research is focused on stopping the spread of rapid ohia death. When I spoke with him 4 weeks into the shutdown, he said that moving forward without his federal partners was proving to be a challenge.
USDA Agriculture Research Service is the main organization doing the pathological research, so the actual disease, how it kills trees, how it moves around. So one of the things that we spent, for example, 2 hours this morning trying to plan is an alternative site for a experiment that is already set to go on, but we can't do it at their facility because it's locked. Partners from the Forest Service on the mainland have already shipped a kiln to Hawaii that we're looking at ways to use it to treat ohia logs. So the kiln is on the barge. It's going to arrive here. It was supposed to be set up at the USDA lab here in Hilo. They are probably still going to be shut when it arrives, so I've been scrambling to figure out how to set it up here at the University of Hawaii campus so we can go forward with the experiment. We have 3 colleagues from the mainland coming to do this experiment with us. 2 of them are university employees, so they'll be able to come, and the 3rd one, again, is a Forest Service employee, so we don't know if she'll be able to come or not. About half of the researchers on rapid ohia death are federal. Some of the other researchers on rapid ohia death are on federal funding, but our University of Hawaii has the funding. So they're able to keep working because we have a grant from the federal government to pay them. So they're still able to work. But one thing I've had to do is I've had to move some of them from their labs at the USDA lab into labs here at the University of Hawaii. We've been able to move some of their equipment, but not all of it. So they're working at a reduced efficiency, even though they're university employees, because they can't get at the labs where they've been working with the USDA labs.
Friday said that scientists started feeling the impact of the shutdown almost immediately.
Oh, we've already had negative impacts. We have workers working all this week and last week that are working at a reduced efficiency because they're not in their normal lab. We started seeing impacts in late December when we started scrambling to try to figure out alternatives to set up some equipment at the university and move it from various federal agencies. I should mention that one of the other federal agencies we work with is the U.S. Geological Survey and Volcano. So we worked with them to get some equipment moved from one of their labs over to one of our labs before the shutdown happened. Any planning that we did for something that didn't happen, we're going to have to start over and get that going again. So there certainly are downstream effects. We're going to start behind once we start getting up to full speed again. We're going to start behind, and it'll take a long time to catch up.
But it isn't all bad news. Christy Martin manages a local working group that coordinates the efforts of government, academia, and nonprofits working on invasive species issues.
It's a good time of year for the shutdown to happen.
That's because research vessels don't travel to the sensitive Northwest Hawaiian Islands this time of year. That's significant because the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration was closed during the shutdown.
NOAA would normally be inspecting vessels and things before they leave for invasive species to protect Papahanao Mokuakea. Not only their ships, but also all of the other ships that might normally go up there. So, you know, the buoy tenders that go up there, they will do an inspection of the hull. Any vessels that go up there need to pass a hull inspection as well as general ship inspection.
For the time being, fewer ships means fewer unwanted pests that could reach the ecologically fragile islands. But that doesn't mean the threat to Papahanao Mokuakea or the rest of Hawaii is any less significant.
Things come in all the time. You're rolling the dice every single day, and sometimes you win and sometimes you lose. There's so many planes and boats coming in, so much coming in, that we're not rolling it every day. We're rolling it every 2 minutes. Those dice are going to come up, snake eyes. You just can't count on winning when you play something like that.
The cost of rolling snake eyes could be staggering. The Hawaii Invasive Species Council estimates that the introduction of just one species, the brown tree snake, could cause more than $2 billion worth of damage annually. I'm Ryan Finnerty for The Conversation.
And to read our stories on the government shutdown, go to hawaiipublicradio.org. Just look for special series from The Conversation.
My name is Terry Savage, and I proudly support Hawaii Public Radio. Listening to HPR is like looking at good art. It offers variety, depth, perspective, and nuance you won't find anywhere else on radio. Not everything I hear is necessarily my cup of tea, and that's okay. HPR's programs stretch my thinking and keep me connected to an ever-changing, complex world.
Member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Officials held off sweeping homeless camps for most of last week because of the annual effort to survey the number of homeless on the streets. HPR's Ku'uwehi Hiraishi joins us this morning to talk about how the point-in-time count went. Morning.
That's right. Good morning, Catherine. I was able to go out with the folks over on the Waianae Coast for that region. I did the town. I did sort of urban Honolulu last year, and wanted to see the difference between going out with the crew out in Waianae. So I was fortunate enough to hook up with Ke Aloha West O'ahu, who's the main outreach service out there for the homeless in Waianae. Jumped into cars, so that's the key difference with doing the point-in-time count out there, was we had to constantly get into a car, go to a beach, and then we'd go out with our clipboards, come back into the car, go to another stretch of beach. So a lot of that. In this first clip, here I am with Regina Kiavepa'ahana. She's an outreach worker for Ke Aloha West O'ahu. She knows a lot of the homeless players in the community already, so that was really helpful in her sort of getting people to get the surveys done and you know, kind of corralling the crowd. But she's just finished surveying this one homeless woman. Her name was Larice Alapa'i. I actually met Larice in town last October. She was at Ala Park. She's been homeless for more than 20 years here in Hawaii. But I asked Alapa'i what she was doing way out here.
Town was getting too much sweeps, and I was tired of losing everything and just tired of putting up with the people that come so close to live with you. It is beautiful out here. I can go out to the air and just look at the stars and just... I pray to the gods like every day just to freaking help me, just help me. Because you know what? Mentally, I'm not all there, but I am.
No matter what, you're a human being, and we love you, Miguel.
Thank you.
So at the end of that was Kiabe Pa'ahana, who's sort of getting a feel for a lot of the service workers. This is an opportunity to have that face-to-face interaction with a lot of the community who may not come in for services. So it's kind of forging that bond at first. So that was an interesting thing to see. But she mentioned, Larice mentioned the sweeps. So we do know, yeah, they held off, city and county and the state did hold off on sweeps. But I think the accumulated effect, because Larice wasn't the only homeless individual that we met during this one day of counting in Waianae that had been that had decided to move out to Waianae instead of staying in town or near places that were actively being swept a lot. So it'll be interesting to see if the data sort of supports that. But last year's data, at least for Oahu, saw that everybody's talking about this 9% drop in homelessness across the island. For Waianae in particular, they had the highest rate of increase last year. So something around 420 homeless individuals unsheltered out in Waianae. And I'm not sure, you know, they talk about how it's a matter of getting folks to do the surveys to, you know, that will be reflected in the data. Sometimes people don't want to do the surveys in other communities. Maybe we're not finding them. Waianae seems to be really good at finding these people. But interpreting the data will be interesting. So we then got back into the car and went to Sewers, which is another stretch of land across from the sewage plant in Waianae. And volunteer Danny Duzinior, she's a program supervisor for the shelters out there, Onelauena and Onemalu. She was saying that she's done the point-in-time count in the past, but that there was one key difference of things that she saw along the count this year.
Now I'm coming across a lot of adults, and I think this is the second family just on this stretch, that brother and sister, but they're like retired, you know, but they supporting one another, you know, the younger one take care of the older one, but the older one is the one with the income, you know. And so like how we have to have multi-generational families in one home to survive, they're doing the same thing, except that theirs is on the beach.
So it was an interesting take on, yeah, what people are seeing. And she was saying herself, she usually spends all day in the shelters and doesn't really get to do any outreach. So being able to go out and see the people that she's trying to get into shelters and then move into permanent housing, these are the sort of issues that they're dealing with, because at her shelters, it's only family and individuals. There's no sort of multi-family type of setup in her shelter. So that's something that might give her something to think about. But going out on these point-in-time count, it can be intimidating at first, especially if you don't know the community. You're going out, you've got folks with clipboards, and you're trying to approach tents of people where you don't know what they're doing, you don't know what condition they're in, if they're mentally ill or need some sort of help. They might think you're, you know, out to get them. So one of the first-time volunteers in the point-in-time count that I met, Celeste Ellison, she's an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer who works with Kealoha West Oahu, but this was her first time going out, and she sort of said that first-time experience really helped her humanize the homeless community.
It's going in with respect and, you know, treating them with that aloha and, you know, talking story and making them feel like a person. Because sometimes, you know, these people, they don't really have anyone to talk to, or, you know, nobody really wants to hear them, and they just need to vent and just have somebody listen. But the good thing with these programs is maybe we can help them coming from this.
Exactly. So ultimately, this data will go towards the department, U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development's efforts to send federal funds our way to deal with homelessness. So we get $9 million a year. Whatever happens with this data at the end of the point in time count will determine if we get more or if we get less.
Right. And I know there was some concern by some in the community that here on Oahu, they were only going to do the count for 3 days versus five, that they had like some 700 volunteers, but they just thought that they could do the count more efficiently.
there was some of that. I think one region even had a one-day count, Region 3. So it was an effort to, yeah, to streamline, but then also do it within the time frame that needs to be done for HUD as well.
Right. You just kind of wonder, though, will they miss somebody?
Right, right. I can assure you in Waianae, they've done kind of gone above and beyond to figuring out where everyone is. Can't speak too much for the other regions, but we will see.
Yeah, and it was interesting where you had that one woman where she was from urban Honolulu, from town, and then moved out there. And then I saw a report where I think someone from a refugee from the Big Island, the Lava,
that's right,
is now in town. So folks just moving around, it seems.
Still homeless, but definitely moving around. Yeah.
You know, one point I should make, I happened to run into someone, a homeless person, a formerly homeless person, and he said, hey, I've got a job. I'm off the street. I have an apartment. So that was kind of nice, you know, just kind of bumping into him. So that was nice to hear.
That is. That's the great news.
Right. So hopefully more. That's a story that a nice ending to a story out there.
Exactly.
All right. Thanks so much, Kuvei. We've been talking with HPR's Kuvei Hiraishi. You can find her stories about the homeless online at hawaiipublicradio.org. This is The Conversation on listener-supported Hawaii Public Radio. We now check in with scientist Christopher Phillips and HPR's Dave Lawrence with your Monday Stargazer.
Stargazer time, our weekly look into the massive universe around our tiny planet, also things we can try and spot in our dark skies. As usual, we are fortunate to have the expertise of astronomer Christopher Phillips at our disposal, and we've got him back on the line right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What's in store this week?
Hey, Dave. It's good to be here. So this week, stargazers, look out for Venus in the east before dawn and keep your eyes peeled for Mars in the west after sunset. The moon continues to wane this week.
And this week we are off on a journey to one of Saturn's moons for an update on the weather there.
We are indeed. Now, as you may remember, last year we covered the demise of NASA's Cassini probe as it came to the end of its decade-long study of Saturn and its moons. The probe itself ended its mission in fiery oblivion in Saturn's upper atmosphere. But the data it collected over the past few years is still being analyzed here on Earth. Scientists studying Titan have discovered that the seasons are changing, with summer about to begin.
And what kind of technology is involved in trying to determine the seasonal changes of a location that far from Earth?
Well, it was a lot of imaging from the Cassini spacecraft itself, and it collected evidence that there is actually rainfall above the North Pole of Titan. Now, let me remind you that Titan is no Earth, and when we say rainfall, what we actually mean is it's liquid methane, not water as we have here on the Earth.
And liquid methane, as we say here in the United States, describe what that would be like if you were actually experiencing it as rain.
Well, it would be incredibly cold because Titan receives about 1% of the sunlight that the Earth does, which means its average temperature is around minus 290 degrees Fahrenheit. So it would be freezing droplets of frozen methane falling on your head.
But on the flip side, I guess it's a great natural resource of some kind.
It is. In fact, Titan is covered with lakes of hydrocarbons, basically things we use for fuel down here on Earth.
So what would, back to summer, that be like on Titan?
Well, as I said, it's very cold and definitely wet, but with fairly calm winds. Now, the seasons on Titan are driven by the fact that it takes Saturn around 29.5 years to orbit the Sun. This means seasons on Titan are long, and all of them are freezing and inhospitable by human standards.
29 years to orbit the Sun.
It's a long time to wait for summer.
Christopher Phillips, and a fascinating report here on Stargazer. Thank you so much.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. We'll catch you next week. And you can find Stargazer at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Stargazer comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to create, maintain, and preserve open spaces for the Maui community. More at haleakalaranch.com.
A A headline in a recent letter to the editor in the Star Advertiser raised eyebrows. It was written by the founder and volunteer director of the Children's Discovery Center, which, by the way, got its start 3 decades ago. We sat down with Loretta Yajima last week to find out more about the homeless situation in Kaka'ako and fears about the dwindling number of visitors.
We actually opened in a small storefront at Dole Cannery Square in donated space, and we moved here 20 years ago. It was such a momentous occasion, and we had a very quiet celebration, and one of the things that I'm writing now is a piece for our internal newsletter, and I wanted to reassure the public that, you know, people have expressed so much concern about whether we're going to close and what can they do to help, and that's been very heartwarming. But I think I ended my piece by saying, now that the candles on our birthday cake are blown out, the fire that fuels the passion that we felt when starting the Children's Discovery Center still burns brightly. And that it is really a message of hope, because we're not giving up. We really feel so passionately about what we do for children and the fact that our children are our future. And it is a message of hope and reassurance.
I have to say, I haven't been down here since the last really big sweep when we had the shanty town. And I thought, oh, it's not so bad. But then I saw pulling up at your back doorstep a number of homeless tents, and then coming around the front and same thing. And then I had to park and walk over here, and I was met with a stench of urine, not exactly a welcoming reception to a children's museum.
Well, Catherine, I'm the first one in the morning, and part of the reason that I come so early is I want to make sure that the grounds are clean, not just for the families and the children that come, but the first ones in the door are our staff. You know, this whole facility needs to be a healthy environment, and we want it to be conducive to joy, happiness, you know, everything that we stand for. And so there's a lot of cleaning up to do in the morning, and you know, I'm sorry that that you experienced that too, and I totally understand how people are a little hesitant when they come into the area, the Kaka'ako Makai area, and that was another reason that I felt motivated. Even though I rarely make any public statements, I felt motivated to write the article, because you can't deny that it's happening. And this is not, I want to be very clear about this, this is not a Children's Discovery Center issue. This is a community issue. It's an issue for our whole state, for our nation, for the world, and we just need to collectively figure out how we're going to resolve this.
This is really, it's about our kids.
It is. It's the bottom line is it's all about the kids. In fact, that's the caption on the front page. We've just celebrated 20 years of joy, wonder, and discovery for children, and it's all about the keiki. It's all about our keiki.
The bottom line is you want to stay here. You've been here 20 years, and you believe you have a future here.
Well, many people don't realize that we actually lease the land from the state. We lease the parcel of land upon which this original city incinerator building sits. And people always ask us, why don't you do something about the parking lots, the sidewalks, the park, and this and that and the other thing. But the parking lots are actually public lots. And all of these lands here are owned by the state, initially under the jurisdiction of Hawaii Community Development Authority. And so that's something that I think people need to realize. We are under a 40-year lease. We have a 40-year lease with the state, and we just celebrated our 20th anniversary. So we have 20 more years. And I've been thinking very carefully about sharing with the board what our options are. And the board unanimously said, we can't close. We've worked so hard to get here, and people love the center. It's such a wonderful educational facility. And we talked about the possibility of moving somewhere, and I said, this might sound funny to say, but after 30 years of doing this full time, I said, I'm probably not going to live another 30 years to raise the money and move someplace else. But that's not the only reason. When we moved here, Governor John Waihe actually invited us to come to Kakaakamakai, and at the time, the parks weren't developed yet. This was a city incinerator, and his vision was to develop 30 acres of park and have the Pacific Ocean at our doorstep. And I thought, you know, of all the children's museums in the United States, because that's where the movement started, we have the Pacific Ocean at our doorstep, 30 acres of park, and we have weather that we can do indoor and outdoor programming all year long. You know, it didn't really take much convincing for us to move down here. And actually, for the first, oh, probably, you know, 5 to 10 years, it was wonderful. We had Keiki fun runs in the area. We had Keiki swap meets. We used the park for outdoor programming. It really was idyllic. And so we do have 20 more years on our lease here, and we'd really love to find a way to stay here. And I still have hope that this park will once again be a place where our local families want to come and the tourists want to come and enjoy the shoreline.
While you've been working to keep the center afloat and build out the rest of the incinerator, you've also been working with museums in China. Tell us about that.
Back in 2011, there was a gentleman from Inner Mongolia, Hohhot Inner Mongolia, and he started a private foundation there. And my husband's business partner said he would like to play golf. And so my husband said, oh, I'll take you to play golf and let's go visit the Children's Museum here, because knowing that his foundation was interested in education. And they came and visited, and I'll tell you, he was here with some of his foundation trustees, and he doesn't speak any English, and I don't speak Chinese. And so, much to my surprise, when they got to the 18th hole, my husband called me and said, Mr. Niu would like to have dinner with you. He's been thinking about what he witnessed by visiting the Children's Discovery Center all day long. And one of my daughters actually worked in Shanghai for a number of years, and so she came to dinner and was a translator for us, and he was so enthusiastic, and he said to me, and these were his words, not mine, he said, I am so inspired. He said, I want to revolutionize early childhood education in China. I want to build 100 children's museums throughout the country. Will you help me? I mean, I had just met this gentleman that morning, and I was stunned. And so I didn't know how serious he was. I didn't know whether the translation was 100% accurate. I clearly was not in a position to move to China. And so I had said to him, you know, there are hundreds of children's museums throughout the United States. The children's museum movement started in the late 1800s in Brooklyn, New York. And I said, you know, my suggestion is maybe visiting some of those museums across the United States. And he said, great idea. Would you lead the effort? And so the next step, early in 2012, I was like a tour guide. We got a big bus. We flew to Indianapolis Children's Museum, which is the largest children's museum in the United States. And then we went across country and visited museums by bus. And I had an interpreter interpreting into Chinese. And I had the microphone facing 30 people on the bus. There were government officials, trustees from the Lao Niu Foundation, and they got to be very big fans of the children's museums. And for the past 6 years, almost 7 years now, I've been going back and forth to China. And we opened the first children's museum in China in Beijing 2 years ago. And it's a lovely museum. They have millions of people going there because the population in China is so vast. And we're opening a very large, the second one in Hohhot, Inner Mongolia, which is the hometown of the foundation. And we're opening that in August of this year. It's over 350,000 square feet under roof, two buildings and a preschool attached to it.
And it's all because a gentleman came by and saw our little, humble Children's Discovery Center here in Kakaako.
Internationally, nationally and internationally, people say the charm of the Children's Discovery Center in Hawaii is something that we will never forget. After we went on that U.S. tour, he said, And in fact, one of the executive directors of one of the large children's museums said, you know, we do consulting all over the world. And he said, your museum is wonderful, but I like hers the best. And I think the charm of our museum here in Hawaii is that we really based it on the population who lives here, wanting to give our children the opportunity to learn about their own ethnic and cultural heritage. And so we have, you know, in addition to a gallery about your body and about your town and Hawaiian rainbows, we also have a rainbow world where children can learn about their own ethnic and cultural heritage. Children's museums are really multi-generational learning. And when grandparents come here, it's their favorite gallery. They love to talk to their grandchildren about what life was like in China or Japan or the Philippines or Vietnam or Korea. So that's very heartwarming.
That was Loretta Ujima of the Children's Discovery Center in Kaka'ako. The day that we did the interview with her was the last day of the point in time count in urban Honolulu, and city crews were in the process of clearing out the illegal campers.
End-of-life care is one of the areas of medicine that is often left behind when talking about treating particular medical illnesses such as heart failure, cancer, COPD, and more. But having that discussion is something we should all do no matter how healthy and young we are. I'm Dr. Kathleen Kozak. Today on The Body Show, we'll talk to an expert to learn more. That's today at 6:30.
We do have to go, but up tomorrow, we sit down with Governor David Ige. It's a call-in show. We would like to hear from you. Call or talk back line, leave us your comments, or pose a question to the governor. Here's a number, 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow, won't you, for more of The Conversation.